This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hill's, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to the New Books Network. My name is Katie Coldiron and I'm based at Florida International University in Miami, Florida. And I have the great pleasure to be interviewing today Mauricio Castro, the author of Only a Few Blocks to Cuba, Cold War, Refugee Policy, the Cuban Diaspora, and the Transformations of Miami, released this year from the University of Pennsylvania Press. Mauricio Castro is Assistant Professor of History and Chair of Latin American Studies at Center College in Kentucky, my alma mater. Thank you so much for being here today, Mauricio.
Thank you for having me.
So what I always like to start out these interviews with is by asking the author how this particular work came to be. So if you wouldn't mind, please tell us a little bit about the origin story of this book.
Well, Katie, there's two answers to that one. And I like to tell these stories in conjunction with each other. I'm originally from Costa Rica, right? And when I was 6 years old, and I was at a bilingual school that my mother worked at, most of her career working, my parents came to me and said, we are taking you to the United States, and we're taking you to Florida. As happens with a lot of Latin Americans, Florida becomes the first place that you encounter as far as the United States go. And my parents said, oh, well, we're going to take you to Miami, and then we're going to go to Disney World. And, you know, I'm 6 years old, mind blown. And I'm learning English. And so even then I was thinking like, well, you know, what I should do is, you know, string together the words of an English sentence that I could say to somebody at a store and feel like a big man, right? Like, you know, and so I worked on it. I kept thinking about, like, you know, what I would say in English, you know, with the seriousness that a six-year-old has. And I got to Miami and everybody spoke Spanish. And so it turns into this lifelong curiosity about Miami. Right? Like, you know, why is this place like this? You know, when I was 6 years old, the question was, why am I even learning English if, you know, this is what the United States is like? Not so much, but Miami was always of interest to me. And when I was in graduate school, my original incarnation was as a historian of popular culture. And I decided along the way that I wanted to do something different. I decided that I wanted to be something more political, urban, all these things. And I was thinking about what to do for a dissertation project. And the dissertation eventually evolved into the book. And I was in a car with my good friend, Timothy Lombardo. He also a University of Pennsylvania Press author. He wrote a book on Frank Rizzo's Philadelphia called Working Class Blue Collar Conservatism. And discussion we were having was about what my project might be, and I was thinking about ways that I could use Spanish, have it be related to Latin America or Latinos, and we had taken some classes on the history of conservatism in the United States, and he said, "Well, what about Cuban conservatives?" And I started thinking about Miami. And the project evolves from there, right? It evolves from this idea that originally I was thinking about Cuban conservatives, and then I was thinking about the city of Miami, and I was thinking about the politics of the place, and it just sort of spun out from there, and it becomes this years-long project that finally culminated in the publication of the book.
Thanks so much for that. So obviously there is a lot of research about Cuban exiles with notable examples including Maria Cristina Garcia's Havana, USA, and Maria de Los Angeles Torres's In the Land of Mirrors. So I really kind of wanted to ask you what you think is different about this book compared to previous interventions.
Absolutely. And both of the works that you mentioned there are sort of foundational to the field, right? Garcia takes this broad view of community formation, and she divides it into, on the one hand, a history of the Cuban migration, and on the other, looking at the politics and culture of the Cuban exile. And Torres has this fantastic, depiction of the sort of the complicated politics of the Cuban exile, and intermixing it with not just her excellent analysis, but also her own history, which is really fascinating. So my work is somewhat different here because it, in some ways, it's concerned with much of the same, right? Cuban migration, Cuban politics, Cuban community formation in South Florida. I am very much focused on Miami as an urban space and looking at the relationship of the city and the Cuban American community with the federal government, with national politics, and to look at how this relationship is dictated by specific policy decisions, right? There's this sense, and I'll, we can discuss this as we go, that the relationship between a Cold War concerned US government and the Cuban diaspora was sort of preordained, right? This idea of a mutual anti-communism. Instead, I wanted to look at how specific decision makers and groups and individuals along the way were engaged in this sort of contested process of connecting the city and the community to the federal government, and how Miami's politics and how the Cuban American community's politics are related to these broader trends. To think about how the city of Miami fits within the broader understanding of trends in American urban history, in foreign policy, and how the city has this significant role in national politics. Because one of the things that I felt strongly for a long time was that there was a lot of excellent work that's been done on Miami and on the Cuban American community. But along the way, there was always a sense of Miami as somewhat of an outlier among, other American cities, and the Cuban American community as an outlier in relation to other groups. And there are historical circumstances that have dictated that perspective, but I saw some connections to these broader structural elements that were like those of other places.
Thank you so much for that. So you begin your first chapter with this really interesting anecdote, which anybody living in Miami today will probably be shocked by, specifically about a Cuba-US friendship parade in Miami in July 1959 that erupted in conflict between two opposing factions. Could you tell us a bit more about this and what it foreshadows about factionalism within the Cuban exile community in coming years?
Absolutely. Yeah, this was a really fascinating event, and I came across it when I was starting my research and looking at Miami Herald microfilm. And it starts with this US-Cuba friendship parade, and there is this the Cuban consul, a man named Alonso Hidalgo, is present at the parade. And as the parade is going, a group, the way that it was described in reports, a group of anti-Castro Cubans drive up in a car, snatch a Cuban flag from the hands of a young girl, and rush off. At which point, Hidalgo and several other pro-Castro Cubans chase this group, and they end up at the home of a Batista-era politician who's now living in Miami, where a Catholic anti-communist rally was being held. And Hidalgo described in the reports as wild and incoherent with rage, starts, launching invective at the men who have taken this flag, which causes the Catholic anti-communists to start streaming out of the house, and it devolves into a fracas, right? Like, there's this like massive brawl in the middle of the street that ends up having to be controlled by Miami's police department. And they call police cars, motorcycle cops, police wagons. It is this honestly ludicrous, incident of violence. And at the time, there was this like significant amount of concern about whether Miami would become a battleground in the changes of politics in the Caribbean, particularly Cuba. And you mentioned that it probably seems very shocking to have a US-Cuba friendship parade, as in relation to how we understand Miami today. But Miami, in when I talk about how things were not preordained, how things were contested, Miami during the Batista years was actually the site of a lot of like anti-Batista struggle, right? It was the site of it was a place where you would people would raise funds, send materiel down to Cuba. It was not a place where you would expect these sort of pro-Batista forces and these like Batista associates to end up, and yet they do early on. And so you end up with these fights happening. And I think that what this really illustrates about what's going to come in the decades that follow is that you're going to have a Cuban and then Cuban American community that is far more ideologically diverse than outsiders will often give it credit for, right? It is this misunderstanding that often happens from the outside, that the views and paints the exile as with a broad brush. And you will see these conflicts continue to bubble up over the decades. And these conflicts are, as scholars of Cuban memory will tell us, is often about the past and about the present, but very importantly, they were about the future, right? There were these like dire, important arguments about what Cuba's future would be like, and as time goes on, increasingly about what Miami's future would be like.
Thank you so much for that. So, kind of staying in the first chapter here, you frame the response to incoming Cuban refugees within the larger Cold War, specifically with the idea that the Cubans would not be staying in the US for very long. That was the assumption of both them and the US government at the time. Could you tell us a bit more about specific policies and structures implemented in the earliest years of exile, as well as the conflict between providing more or less government support?
movement of people out of revolutionary Cuba was seen by the Dwight D. Eisenhower White House as a major propaganda coup, right? It would still take a couple of years before the Eisenhower White House would refer to Fidel Castro's Cuba as being, quote unquote, communist control. Yes. But let's be honest, they never particularly cared for the revolution. And so the idea of the movement of people out of Cuba and into the United States, well, it looked good, right? Every well-dressed Cuban refugee was a potential spokesperson against Marxism in Latin America, both in the United States to shore up domestic anti-communism, but also potentially in the broader Latin American context. And so, and so it becomes this article of faith, right? That the Eisenhower administrations and subsequent administrations would embrace the Cubans because of their shared anti-communism. But history is always messier, right? Like, history is always messier and more interesting than these narratives that we tell ourselves about the past. And we're going to see that in those early years, the policies of the Eisenhower administration are going to evolve, particularly as local actors and Cuban refugees themselves start to push against this initial policy of benign neglect. Because what the Eisenhower administration was doing was essentially allowing as many Cubans who wanted to enter the United States. But the thing was that most of these Cuban migrants who were coming to the US in the aftermath of the revolution were coming under tourist visas. There was a danger, it was thought, and there was a danger, it was thought, to declaring oneself an exile or a refugee because of what might happen back in Cuba to friends, family, to property. And so a lot of the very early arrivals come to Miami and to the United States under tourist visas that they just then overstay. So the Eisenhower administration simply turns a blind eye. They allow as many entrances as possible. They then do not proceed to check up on tourist visa overstays. And so what happens is that the Cuban population starts to grow and grow and grow, particularly in South Florida. And this understandably creates chaos in the city of Miami. I mean, the that this flow begins as a trickle and then becomes far more substantial. And Miami was, not the sort of sprawling metropolitan area that we think of now, right? Miami was, much smaller then. It was also a city that, the way that its mayor put it to Congress in seeking help related to this was a city where 62% of the population depended on seasonal tourism for all or part of their income. And so a growing population of these displaced people who were at first being taken care of largely by other members of the established Cuban community and who become what the Miami Herald called our unnoticed neighbors, start to strain the ability of the city to take care of them, particularly because under those tourist visas, they couldn't work. And frankly, there was not a very elastic labor market to accommodate them. And so increasingly, there is going to be a push to try to provide assistance for these new arrivals. And the question becomes at the federal level whether that is going to send the message that the United States government tacitly accepts the permanence of the Cuban Revolution, right? If you start to find a path towards normalization for the Migratory status of the people who arrived under those visas. If you try to create a program of assistance, the thought was you are acknowledging that, Castro and the revolution are in Cuba to stay. And the expectation was that eventually the United States would engineer the fall of Fidel Castro, or that the revolution would fail and that these people would be able to return. The thing is, circumstances on the ground were not going to wait for a potential change in Cuba. And ultimately, local actors, including the city's government, the city's press, the Catholic Church, and others, are going to push for the federal government to become more involved. And as the book continues, I sort of outline the ways in which the decisions were made that ultimately led to a very robust system of support for the Cuban refugee population.
Thank you so much for that. And you foreshadowed my next question for you, which is concerning your second chapter, where you show that both the federal government as well as private groups like the Catholic Church begin to get more involved with Cuban refugees. And so to that end, I would like to ask you about the differences between the federal versus the private response to newly arriving Cuban exiles in the 1960s.
Well, the really interesting bit about that, and I love that question, is that at a certain point, they become one and the same. See, in the beginning, as I mentioned earlier, the arriving Cubans are relying on friends and family. Then they start relying on then they start relying on familiar institutions like the Catholic Church. And there had been a concerted effort by the Catholic Church to increase its outreach towards Spanish-speaking congregants in the years prior to the Cuban Revolution. And so the Catholic Church is going to start spending a good amount of its funds under the Catholic Charities to provide medical assistance, to provide food, to provide other types of help for these new arrivals. And this is going to spread from there, right? It's not just going to be the Catholic Church, it's going to be all sorts of private charities. All of these groups are going to come together in the aftermath of these new Cuban arrivals becoming their main constituent group that they are serving, to try to push for a federal response. And the federal response under the Eisenhower administration is very, well, they might have described it, particularly the emissary that they sent down to Miami would have described it as cautious. I believe that the people of Miami might have described it as slow. But ultimately, what happens is that under the Kennedy administration, you see the creation of the Cuban Refugee Program. And the Cuban Refugee Program is going to be a massive infrastructure that ultimately that disperses about $2 billion of aid and different types of assistance, and which I go into in more detail in the book. But what's really fascinating about this is that a lot of these organizations that have been helping the Cubans that get folded in to the workings of the Cuban refugee program. And let me give you an example for that. One of the significant aims of the federal government and of many of, the figures of authority in Miami was to resettle as many Cubans away from Miami as possible, right? To sort of distribute the as they would have put it, the burden of this refugee population, and to have them in other parts of the country. And while the federal government was paying for this, the process of refugee resettlement was handled within the Cuban Refugee Center, what we call the Freedom Tower today. by private organizations. There was the Catholic Relief Services, the Protestant Latin American Emergency Committee of the Church World Service, the United Hebrew Immigrant Aid Society Service, and the International Rescue Committee. And so you ca had options for refugees to seek assistance in resettling based on their preference of religious identification or secular desire for secular assistance. So what ultimately happened is that there is a private public partnership that is made possible by this very generous bit of public funding from the federal government.
Thank you. So, moving on to your next chapter, you focus on the early response to Cuban exiles within the local South Florida community, and particularly the tension due to the benefits they had received compared to other demographic groups here, particularly African Americans. And as anyone who knows South Florida, the legacies of those tensions continue to exist. So, I was hoping you could tell us a little bit more about this phenomenon.
By the time I get to that chapter, I'm writing about largely the second half of the 1960s, particularly the late 1960s. There is some stuff earlier than that, but when we're talking about the local politics, by the late 1960s, that question about acknowledging the permanence of the Cuban community in the United States, and particularly in South Florida, well, that's been settled. You know, this has been it's been years, and the Cuban community is in Miami for the foreseeable future. There's still a desire among the exile and among the federal bureaucracy for an end to the revolutionary government, but this is not something that's going to be solved, you know, in a day, a week, a month, or even a year. So increasingly, other parts of Miami's population, other residents, start to wrestle with the idea of this sort of permanence. And among African Americans, there was a lot of frustration, right? This was, of course, you know, as we're getting into the late 1960s, there was a lot of frustration, particularly among urban African Americans, with the slow pace of change. And this was seen in a lot of cities across the United States. And in that sense, Miami was no different. What was different here was that in the politics of Miami were never just black and white. Even before the Cuban Revolution, there were it was, things were a lot more complicated. And for African American critics, here was a population that was receiving essentially unprecedented levels of welfare state assistance based on the condition of need. And that word really stuck in the minds of a lot of African American critics of these programs. Because if you looked at African American communities in Miami, the condition of need was very, very well present. And so while these critics acknowledge that the condition of exile, of not being able to go home, of having this feeling that you had lost your country, was terrible and moving, and that they felt that the Cuban population did deserve assistance, they questioned why they did not, right? Was the experience of leaving revolutionary Cuba really that much more traumatic than, you know, 300 years of being an underclass in the United States? If we think about it in terms of you know, how the relationships between African Americans and city governments and their cities, you know, when the Kerner Commission report comes out, right, there's this very often quoted line, right, about the country moving towards two societies, right? One white, one black, both inherently unequal. For Miami's African American critics of the Cuban refugee program, of Cuban assistance, to a degree of the Cuban presence, there was a significant frustration because what they saw was not two societies splitting apart. In Miami, for them, they saw three. And while the levels of assistance and the social positioning of Cubans was not quite the same as, white Anglo-Americans, it was still a level of assistance and a level of embrace by the federal government far beyond anything that their community had ever received. It was an incredibly frustrating moment for the community, and it's going to have long-term consequences for relations between African Americans and Cuban Americans, as you mentioned just now.
Thank you so much. So in chapter four, or excuse me, in chapter three, you foreshadow the creation of the Cuban exile political bloc and how they were courted by Democrats versus how they were courted by Republicans. So I was hoping you could expand a little bit on this phenomenon and the difference between how each party approached Cuban Americans.
Certainly. One of the things that I try to do in that chapter is to think about, again, these sort of common knowledge understandings of, like, how the exile and Cuban Americans came by their politics, right? Again, I'm trying to portray the diversity of thought within the community, the diversity of ideology and political belief. But there is, this long-held sort of popular myth that even seeps into some academic writings that simply, in the aftermath of the Bay of Pigs invasion, the Democratic Party completely lost the Cuban American community, as if, what happened at Bahía Cochinos had just simply, like, been a flip of a light switch, and forever this community was lost. Not so much, right? Like, this is again, right? This is a process that is based on the actions, the approaches of different groups, right? And individuals. And it's not as if, anti-communism wasn't a bipartisan sport in Washington, D.C., right? And what I try to do in this chapter is to think about ways in which often the Cuban American community has become to be associated with Republicanism. And again, kind of a flattening view, but scholars of Latino voting patterns like Geraldo Cadava and Benjamin Francis Fallon have often talked about that association as having solidified by the 1980s. And what I'm trying to do here is to think about it in very localized terms in South Florida and to talk about that process in the late 1960s and early 1970s. Because the process that we see here, right, is that on a national level, the national security establishment is still working with, Cuban exile political organizations in the aftermath of the Bay of Pigs, right? Like people like the Cuban Revolutionary Council, right? This is a fraught relationship, but it has not, completely fractured. Eventually, there will be, further distance between these groups. But on a local level, after the 1966 Cuban Adjustment Act, right, that allows for, Cubans in the United States to start nationalizing and naturalizing. So after the 1966 Cuban Adjustment Act, which allows for Cubans in the United States to naturalize as American citizens and to become voters, there's going to be a level of organization at the local level to try to attract them as voters. And so you'll have figures like Representative Dante Fascell, longtime Democratic rep for the Miami area, who very actively courts the Cuban vote and who, builds up his, anti-communist bona fides, right? And he makes speeches. But at an organizing level, a pattern is going to start developing in the late 1960s and into the 1970s that Cuban American Democrats and Democrats who have a knowledge of the Cuban American community warn the party about. And that's the fact that they are being out organized by the Republican Party in recruiting these individuals as voters. And so you're going to see recruitment at even swearing in ceremonies, right? Like these naturalization ceremonies will have after at the end of them, there'll be booths where the Republican Party is seeking to specifically invite these new Cuban Americans to become members of the Republican Party, which sends them the message that they are both wanted and needed. And so while there is, these broader geopolitical forces that will dictate a lot of how Cuban Americans relate to the two major political parties, this there is also a story of local organizing and local politics and how this will end up having this broader effect on national politics, which, in an election year, particularly how often political analysts are very confused about like what's happening in Florida. There are these longer term effects to this history.
Thank you so much for that. So moving on, in chapter four, you begin to show how exile becomes more permanent. And with that, there are increased tensions between Cubans and the Anglo community in Miami, as well as within the Cuban community itself here. So I was hoping you could tell us a little bit more about this.
Of course, certainly. This is a period where, that permanence really has taken hold, right? And by the 1970s, the Cuban community in Miami is seeking to consolidate and secure the gains that they have made in the city, right? This is, for many, Miami had been intended to be this brief stop, right? A place to regroup and prepare for their inevitable return to Cuba. By the 1970s, you have thousands of Cuban-owned businesses, you have an increasing participation of Cubans who have naturalized into local politics, although that is fraught, and I'll get to that in a moment, the naturalization issue. And so more and more Cuban Americans want to have a say in how the city that they're calling home is run. And there are many among the Anglo community who are very complimentary of the contributions of the Cuban community. Right. There are many who have found ways to, make peace with whatever anxieties they might have about that Cuban presence, who often see some significant contributions in the Cuban character that a lot of places in Miami have started to take on. I mean, and this is, where we see the adoption of this idea of Dade County and the ordinance that's passed that declares Dade County as a bilingual and bicultural, right? Not everyone feels that way, clearly. And I mean, this should not be news to anyone who has lived through the last few years, right? The arrival of populations from abroad is always going to be the cause of anxiety. The process by which these populations are integrated into society is always fraught. It's always contested, and there is going to be a sense among a lot of Anglo-Miamians that they're being displaced, right? That this feeling that they don't recognize their city. And this is going to lead to some really ugly sentiments a lot of the time, particularly when we get to the 1980s. And so while the Cuban community is trying to consolidate its economic and social and political gains, there will be a brewing discontent among a segment of Miami's white Anglo population. Now, within the Cuban community, you have these debates going on, right? Like there's been excellent work done about these sort of generational debates among younger Cubans and older Cubans. But one of the topics I focus on is the question of naturalization, right? Because again, there's always the question of what message your actions are sending. The debate among the Cuban community was, if you choose to ex you know to begin the process of naturalization and you become an American citizen, does that signal that you have given up on Cuba, right? On the idea of that future of Cuba, right? This is a question about what the future of Cuba is going to look like and what your part is going to be in bringing about that future. And if you become an American, what does that mean about your commitment to that? So there are these ongoing debates about that, but where things get very, very contentious and sometimes violent is with the question of whether to engage with Castro's government in negotiation and dialogue, right? When a very ideologically diverse group of Cubans in exile go to negotiate and speak with Fidel Castro, this creates a significant backlash, right? A lot of other members of the community, their reactions range from thinking that it's folly to discuss with Castro and that it only strengthened his hands, to others who label this treasonous. And they go beyond harsh words, right? There are incidents in which there are assassination attempts and sometimes successful ones. And so it becomes this very, very painful moment for the Cuban American community, right? And while this negotiation does ultimately lead to some concessions from the Castro government, it is an incredibly contentious moment.
Thank you so much for that. So moving into the 80s, as you foreshadowed, Chapter 5 largely concerns the Mateo boat lift of 1980, a really climactic point in both Cuban history and the history of Miami and the US more broadly. And of course, the boat lift brought approximately 125,000 Cubans to South Florida. So I was hoping you could tell us a little bit more about this. Why did the boat lift happen? What happened to the refugees once they got here? And did they get similar benefits as the earlier waves of Cuban exiles?
Thank you. The thing about that is we think about 125,000 people. It's a almost unimaginable number when we're really conceiving of it. And it takes place over the course of just a few months, right? This is an incredible movement of people, and it is as chaotic an event as I cover in my work. But it all arises out of the increasing sort of economic and social and political pressures in Cuba. The federal government had made a the US government had made a the US government had made an agreement with Fidel Castro to bring Cubans who sought to leave their country to the United States. And we had the so-called freedom flights, right? Like these flights that brought more and more Cuban refugees out of the island to the United States. And that is going to be another huge population movement, but it was done in a far more orderly manner and in a way that had been negotiated by the federal government and took place over the course of years. But those end in 1973. You know, Castro's government feels that, you know, the freedom flights have become counterproductive for their aims. And so over the years that follow, there is going to be a lot of frustration among the Cuban population, right? Because of economic reasons, because of ideological reasons, because of, you know, the shifts to the Cuban culture, right? And the adoption of some, you know, Soviet models. And by 1980, Cuba's at a boiling point. And that migration had long been, well, it had been two things, right? It had been for Fidel Castro a tool or weapon to use against the United States government, but also a pressure release valve in Cuba, right? If you made it so that the people who were unhappy and were willing to leave were able to leave, well, fewer unhappy people in the country, yes. And so what's going to happen is that there's going to be a rash of instances in which Cubans hop the walls of embassies, right? They're seeking to leave the country to get asylum. And there will be an incident with a bus driver named Hector Sanjustis, who along with some Confederates, you know, they take the bus from his work, and they just essentially ram it through the gates of the Peruvian embassy to try to ask for sanctuary within the embassy. And there is a reaction by the Cuban guards that have been assigned to the embassy, and in the chaos and crossfire, there is the, you know, there comes the death of one of those guards. And so when the Peruvian embassy staff ultimately gives asylum to this group, well, Castro sees a potential for a propaganda coup, right? You know, you want to give asylum to these dissatisfied, you know, and in the view of the revolution, antisocial people, fine. So they tear down the walls to the embassy compound, and people start walking through. And, you know, you very quickly get 2,000 people, and very quickly those 2,000 become over 10,000. This embassy crisis becomes a major flashpoint, particularly because it allows for Castro to make wild claims, right, about these people being the, you know, the escoria, the scum of society, right? The lumpen proletariat, right? They have antisocial tendencies. There's claims about, like, you know, crime dropping precipitously after, you know, these people are now on the embassy grounds. And they start negotiating with Peru, with the United States, with other Latin American countries to send some of these almost 11,000 people away from Cuba. And a lot of the images that come out of that, of these people who had been on the embassy grounds being overjoyed, sometimes kissing the tarmac when they arrived elsewhere, were extremely embarrassing for the Castro government. And so Castro decides, well, he decides to stick his thumb in the eye of both the, you know, Cuban exile community and the United States government by declaring that the port of Mariel will be open for anyone who wants to come and retrieve friends and family. Right? There had been a previous boat lift in the 1960s, the Camarioca boat lift, and Mariel elicits a massive response from the Cuban American community. They start renting out every, you know, available boat of, dubious seaworthiness or, varying types of seaworthiness between Miami and New Orleans, and they start sending these boats to Mariel. Now, the catch, right, is that when these boat captains would arrive with a list of people that they were looking to take back to the United States, perhaps they might get part of the list. Maybe if they got extremely lucky, they might have all the members of that family or friends who were on that list of the person who had contracted the boat. But Cuban authorities would also overload the boat past capacity with other individuals, right? And this makes for some incredibly dangerous sea crossings. Castro also provides an opportunity for people who have been imprisoned for various offenses, including things that would not have been considered criminal in the United States or elsewhere, to join the boat lift. He puts people who had been in mental health facilities and elsewhere, and puts them as includes them in the boat lift. And this allows him to continue to paint anyone who wants to leave Cuba as being scum. One of the very unfortunate things that happens then is that the American press, starting with an article in the New York Times, is only too happy to go along with this characterization, right? While originally there had been this sense of welcoming the Mariel entrance or the Marielitos, as they come to be known, with open arms, very quickly the inclusion of those who were seen as undesirable elements, ranging from people with mental health issues, intellectual disabilities, people who had been imprisoned, members of Cuba's LGBTQ community, who are seen as undesirable by both the Cuban government and by many in the United States, is going to lead to this incredibly negative perception of the people of the Mariel boat lift. And so 125,000 people arrive in the United States within a few months. And this far exceeds any one year of the previous waves of migration. And there is a very different welcome that these people receive, right? The process, let's not romanticize the process by which earlier waves of Cuban refugees were admitted into the city and into the United States. But there is this, incredibly stigmatizing process that takes place in how these individuals are brought into these massive central processing facilities in military bases, in large public infrastructure buildings, and how they are processed as they arrived. The Carter administration, I mean, we're essentially on the eve of what, this is sometimes referred to as the Reagan Revolution, but already neoliberalism has really shaped and limited the imagination of people in the Carter administration as to what potentially could be done to welcome these individuals. And so the levels of assistance that the people of the Mariel boat lift receive is far more meager than anything that had been previously received by previous waves of refugees. And this is going to have an effect that is traumatizing both for the people of the Mariel boat lift, and which is going to have some fairly unfortunate consequences for the city of Miami as well.
Thank you so much for that. So, chapter six shows the emergence of Cuban American political power, particularly through the rise of the Cuban American National Foundation, but also talks about the limits to that power. Could you tell us a bit more about the foundation and its impact in both South Florida and beyond?
Certainly. One of the things that the Cuban American National Foundation has in common with a lot of other Cuban American political organizations is that it is often founded out of a feeling of concern and unsteadiness of the place of Cuban Americans in American society. And in this case, the backlash to the Mariel boatlift was so significant, right, that by 1981, a lot of like very prominent, very wealthy Cuban Americans are concerned about the community's image and the community's standing. And so the foundation becomes a way for wealthy and prominent Cubans to push the federal government towards taking more strict anti-Castro stances. The implications of that are amazing, right? These are members of a community that had been the recipient of this huge amount of federal largesse just 2 decades before, and now here they are having an outsized effect on American foreign policy and its construction. And so, well, how did they do this? Well, this might date the episode a little bit, but a few days ago, former U.S. Senator and vice presidential candidate Joe Lieberman died. And Joe Lieberman has something to do with the story. I mean, like, what does a centrist Connecticut Democrat have to do with the Cuban American National Foundation? Well, in 1988, Joe Lieberman was running for the U.S. Senate against incumbent Lowell Weicker Jr. And the incumbent had failed to pass the litmus test for anti-Castro stances of the Cuban American National Foundation. Now, the Cuban American National Foundation did not make direct political contributions. They left that to their political action committee, the Free Cuba PAC, which was modeled after the American-Israeli Public Affairs Committee. And so, in a very, very close election, Lieberman receives a ton of assistance from the Free Cuba PAC and ultimately like ends up gaining that seat in the Senate, winning by less than 1%. And so he will continue to have the assistance of the Cuban American National Foundation for years to come. And so the endorsement of the Cuban American National Foundation and its financial assistance and its clout is often very sought out by a lot of federal policymakers beyond Florida. So it ends up having this very significant impact on American politics.
Thank you so much for that. So, also in chapter six, you turn to this really dark side of the Mariel saga, which is specifically prison riots in Atlanta and Oakdale, Louisiana, in 1987 by Marielitos, or those who had arrived from the via the Mariel boat lift, who had been detained for years at that point. What was the background of these events? Why did they spread between states, and how were they ultimately resolved?
That's a great question. Thank you. It is a very, very dark moment. This is rooted in that lack of a comprehensive assistance. This is rooted in the lack of a greater level of assistance for the Marielitos, right? Assistance that previous groups of Cuban refugees had received had been, in many ways, very generous. And when you put tens of thousands of new arrivals into the streets of Miami without assistance, without programs to really ensure their survival, I mean, a fairly natural outcome of this is going to be a rise in crime. And some of this was, various types of crime, some of it violent, a lot of it nonviolent. A lot of it was even, being couriers for the burgeoning drug trade in the city, right? Here you take this package from, this part of the city to this other part of the city, you'll get $200. And, then the person gets caught by the police and suddenly they're a drug dealer, right? The justice system was overwhelmed by this growth in crime in the city. And so the state attorney for Dade County, Janet Reno, who would go on to be the attorney general under Bill Clinton, starts offering reduced sentences to these marineros. What happens then is that the marineros are not also informed that by pleading guilty, they have now become excludable from the country, right? It means that the moment that their sentences have been served, they are eligible for deportation. The thing about that is, right, that the Cuban government had no intention of taking back anyone who came over during the Mariel boat lift, right? After all, they had made all that noise about them being the scum of society and so forth and so on. There had been an agreement in 1984 for a potential deportation of some of those individuals, but ultimately that agreement falls apart because the federal government begins Radio Martí, and as a protest to that, the Cuban government tears up that 1984 agreement. So what happens is that there are thousands of Cuban detainees in immigration facilities and in federal prisons that are being held indefinitely because they have served their sentence and it is done, but they are, ready for deportation. Deportation will not come because the Cuban government will not take them back. The US government will not release them back into the United States because legally, there's the legal fiction that they are outside of the United States. And that's only those who had been convicted of something and had already served their sentences. There were people who had been in detention for years who had never been convicted of anything or even charged with a crime. And so these detainees had been in prisons for years, and there had been those who advocated for them. The auxiliary bishop, Catholic bishop of Miami, Agustin Roman, his legal counsel, Rafael Peñalver, the Atlanta Legal Aid Society, other sort of civil liberties advocates, and a first-term U.S. representative from Atlanta, civil rights legend John Lewis, right? Like all of these people had pointed to this indefinite detention and said this is unconstitutional and un-American, right? It didn't really matter. Like these detainees were held in these facilities that were sometimes several times over capacity, right, in terms of how many people were there. And so what happens is that in 1987, after hearing for many years, these warnings from people on the outside not to be allowed, that they should not be deported because of the gruesome fates would await them in Cuba, there is this rumor that spreads that like the 1984 agreement is about to be reinstated because there have been some negotiations. And this ultimately leads to a hostage crisis because the federal detention immigration center in Oakdale, Louisiana, sees hundreds of these Cuban detainees come out brandishing homemade weapons and they take 28 hostages. Within a few days, the detainees at the Atlanta Federal Penitentiary follow suit. And so a lot of their advocates try to, intercede. Some members of the Cuban American community also tried to negotiate on behalf of the federal government, but ultimately the detainees sought the assistance of Agustin Roman, the auxiliary bishop. And so Roman, who had been a constant advocate for them, and his legal counsel Rafael Peñalver, continued to negotiate with Edwin Meese. With the help of some members of the community, and ultimately they're going to lead to the end of the hostage crisis. Unfortunately, this is not the end of the road for these detainees, and I detail in the book how the process of individual review that they gain and secure through this negotiation takes years. And it's not going to be until almost 20 years later in 2005 that the US Supreme Court rules that the indefinite detention of Cuban detainees was unconstitutional. And even then, that practice has not really ended.
Thank you so much for that. So kind of alluding to what you concluded with just there, I really wanted to ask you about what, in your view, what the phenomena that you've discussed in your book and in this interview, what that looks like today for Cuban exiles and particularly those in Miami.
Yes, absolutely. The events and the trends and the decisions that I discuss in the book had these long-term effects on the city. That's why I, you know, the title uses transformations of Miami, right? These multiple transformations that I discuss. And you know, it's been many, many, many decades, right? And so the Cuban community has continued to grow, right? The you know, Cuban Americans have been born in the United States. More people have come from Cuba in different phases of migration. But Miami, by virtue of that Cuban presence, became a magnet for people from other countries in Latin America. So today's Miami, while it still has a very distinct and very influential Cuban American community, is not the Miami, you know, of 1959. It's not even the Miami of 1987, right? It is a Miami that is filled with other, you know, people from other areas of Latin America, right? And it's created this new landscape by virtue of this, right? And a lot of the change Miami-Dade County now electrics that policymakers and political scientists had been predicting for years have started to, like, you know, have an influence on national electoral politics. And this, like, you know, very significant influence on, you know, the broader American political scene. But in many ways, needing to return to Cuba are now dead. And even an event like Fidel Castro's death in 2016, right, while greeted with a huge amount of fanfare on the streets of Miami, did not fundamentally change anything. And so, you know, today's Miami is not the sort of pre-revolutionary Miami. It is not exactly a Cuban Miami, but it is the Miami that was built by the diaspora and the decisions of the federal government in conjunction with one another.
Thank you. So at the end of these interviews, I always like to give the author space to tell us a little bit about some current or future projects. So if you have anything you'd like to share, we'd love to hear about it.
Sure. I am currently in the early stages of doing some research and envisioning a project on Latino banking as a sort of a broad category, right? And some of it will grow out of the project that I just discussed, right? And how the Cuban American, well, you know, initially the Cuban exile and then the Cuban American community conducting banking in unique ways, particularly in South Florida. But that's not the only story. There are places to go and stories to follow in places like, you know, North Carolina or New York or other spots that I'm thinking about and with other communities. And I think that I've become taken with the idea that the way we bank as far as you know, these sort of Latino or Latino serving banking institutions has a lot to say about the place of these communities in the United States and how they've come to be affected and they've come to affect the local communities that they call home.
Sounds fascinating. Thank you so much for sharing that. This has been Only a Few Blocks to Cuba, Cold War Refugee Policy, the Cuban Diaspora, and the Transformations of Miami by Mauricio Castro. The book is available via the University of Pennsylvania Press. Thank you so much again, Mauricio.
You're most welcome. Thank you for having me. This has been great.